The whole nuclear mess. It's hard keeping up with all the many ways that nuclear thinking and messaging is wrong. From climate change to conflict deterrence to electricity generation, nuclear is not a solution. It's a morass of problems that just keeps getting worse with every ill-planned decision by the industry that's then promoted to or backed by the government. Nuclear puts us all at risk. The entire planet and all life on it. And right now, there's nothing substantive in place that's turning this pro-nuclear juggernaut around. In order to fight back, we need to know the full truth about the industry, what it does, its weaknesses, and its manipulation of the truth. When it comes to the ingrained problems with nuclear reactors, it takes a genuine expert to succinctly explain what and where the problems are. And when she tells you just a few of the problems,
you look at technically the flaws in some of these reactors. They're prone to fires, they're prone to explosions, you know, they're untested. And we've got a regulatory environment which is being decapitated, which means that you've got reactors that are dangerous, labeled as dangerous by the physicists who understand them. And yet they're going to be fast-tracked and there'll be an end run around safety and there won't be evacuation zones because they're so small. It's really alarming how quickly they're being brought on without at least some of the safety barriers that were in place, albeit from a regulator that's been a lapdog to the industry for a long time, but at least better than nothing. But now it's looking very alarming indeed.
Indeed. And that's just a sliver of her wide-ranging understanding of all things nuclear. So when world-class journalist and activist Linda Pence Gunter authors a new book, No to Nuclear, she means it. And the book covers the full range of nuclear problems, as well as what we might do about them. It enriches the reader with another set of angles on that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and those who already know something who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, I talk with Linda Pence Gunter. She is founder and executive director of Beyond Nuclear, and she has just published a new book, No to Nuclear, Why Nuclear Power Destroys Lives, Derails Climate Progress, and Provokes War. That pretty much says it. Linda has been a regular contributor to Nuclear Hot Seat with her Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story feature since 2022. The book covers almost every aspect of the nuclear industry, and so do we in our wide-ranging extended interview. We will also have lots more honest and verified nuclear information from around the world, all of it coming up in the next few moments. Today is Tuesday, March 31st, 2026. And here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here's this week's featured interview. For this show, I have the privilege of working with some tremendously skilled, knowledgeable, and big-hearted people. But we're so focused on the work that we do, we don't get a chance to engage in longer, more wide-ranging conversations. That's why this week's featured interview is a particular joy for me. It is with Linda Pence Gunter. She is a former journalist with Reuters, USA Network, The Times of the UK, and other outlets. She is founder and executive director of Beyond Nuclear, the head of Beyond Nuclear International newsletter, which she curates and writes for. making it one of our most reliable sources for nuclear information. She is also, I'm proud to say, the brains and voice behind the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, a regular feature on the show since 2022. Her new book is No to Nuclear: Why Nuclear Power Destroys Lives, Derails Climate Progress, and Provokes War. It was published in March of 2026 by Pluto Press, and that's what we're here to talk about. I spoke with Linda Pence Gunter on March 27, 2026. Linda Pence Gunter, it's so unique to have you as a guest on Nuclear Hot Seat. Welcome.
Thank you. I get to talk for more than 3 minutes now, which I do sometimes anyway, I know.
In all the time that you have been doing the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, we haven't done a proper interview. So I'm going to just take this from the basics. What is your background, and especially what has your focus been on journalism?
Well, in journalism, I started out actually as a tennis reporter, which is not what people expect to hear at all. But, you know, I wanted to be a movie critic, actually, but that's the path I fell into. But it was a very good way of just learning the ropes. I was a stringer for Reuters for a long time, and Reuters has no deadlines because it's, you know, somewhere, somebody's awake somewhere in the world at any given time. So I was always the last person out of the press room. And it was a very good learning experience on assimilating news quickly and getting a story out that was concise and hit all the essentials and so forth. So that was sort of my training ground, which, although it was in a particular subject area, was quite generic, I think, to progressing into writing about something else, i.e. nuclear power and nuclear weapons. I mean, obviously, I approach it from a journalistic point of view, but I'm also a kind of all-rounder in terms of founding an organization beyond nuclear, running the day-to-day, doing the fundraising, doing the media. So I've had to learn a lot of other things. But I have to say, my first day was in 1998. My birthday, actually, January 6, 1998, on this issue. And I had to learn reprocessing and mocks right away, because that was the funder for that position was interested in that. And I felt like a complete imposter for a while. I thought, I'll never understand this, but I do. And I think, you know, it shows the human capacity to learn new things. And that was something I had to learn.
You mentioned Beyond Nuclear, and you were one of the founders of that organization. Considering your position there and the fact you're also a journalist, what is the relationship between the two for you?
It's communication. You know, that's really the most important thing, how we communicate this issue to a wider public. And I think what journalism teaches you, especially if you're in sort of mass market journalism, is how to tell the story so that it can be not only understood by the readers, but they might feel, you know, motivated to engage in a greater way. And that's what we obviously need now, is more and more people, especially as the threat ramps up of new nuclear power plants, new uranium mines, and so forth, is to communicate this message and this issue in a way that anybody can understand it and will feel motivated to participate in some way to stop the expansion of nuclear power and nuclear weapons.
Your book, No to Nuclear, has just been published. Why this book? Why now? And who is your target market?
Okay, I'll see if I can remember all those three questions. why this book is really, I've sort of started to answer that, which is I really felt like, although there are lots of really excellent reports, technical studies, you know, long detailed things that communicate what we need to know about why we should oppose nuclear power for a myriad of reasons, but there wasn't something that really put the human face on the story. And that to me was missing, is like telling the story from the point of view of the people to whom it happens, whether you're beginning at the fuel chain, uranium mining, through the processing of the fuel, through the production of electricity, through the generation of waste, through the transition to nuclear weapons. You know, there are victims all the way along that story, and their stories really needed to be front and center because I think people can identify better with that. And I also wanted to take a more holistic approach and put the whole addiction to nuclear power and nuclear weapons in a wider context of how we steward our planet and what we're not doing on climate, which answers the third question, which is really that the audience I wanted to reach is not so much you know, people like you and me, but the people you know who might be on the fence or who might be being bamboozled by the propaganda and who really would relate better to hearing the stories from the people to whom it happens or from the animal point of view, you know, if you care about animals, nature, space, the wonder of the universe, you know, all those things are kind of in the book. The reason to do it now is partly to do with the tsunami of propaganda, the saturation propaganda campaign that is fueling the idea that we all should want our tax dollars to be squandered on new nuclear power plants when this is like the absolutely worst, most expensive decision we can make in a climate crisis. You know, it's actually counterproductive, which is what I try to show in the book, to mitigating the climate crisis. It's also in the way of disarming from nuclear weapons. And so we're in an urgent situation. That said, I don't expect my book to match the millions, if not billions, of propaganda dollars that are spent by the industry on politicians, on the media, and so forth. But we have to do something, and we've got to do it from the ground up, which is why it's written in a very accessible, down-to-earth, sometimes humorous way, is so that everybody can understand it and use it. You know, whatever piece of the book appeals to you, you can use that to fuel arguments in your own communities to stop nuclear power plants, whether they're being used for AI centers or electricity or the weapons connection, to stop them from coming into your community and or uranium mines or waste dumps.
You talk about the propaganda, the PR campaign. What has made it so virulent? Is it solely the money? Is it greed? Is it a planetary blind spot? Is it some malign influence that just wants to destroy everything because somebody had a bad childhood?
Who knows what the answer really is, other than what we can surmise from what we see. And I think we're in an environment now where big money is controlling everything. You can see the stranglehold that the billionaire bros have on what we do, you know, what we develop or don't develop, which direction we go in or we don't go in. So it's all about instant profit. None of it's about long-term stewardship of the world we live on. So I think that drives it. I mean, not to diverge too much, but when you look at everything that's unraveling with the Epstein files, you've got a great big boys club there, right? I mean, everybody seems to be in it. And some surprising people are in it, even tangentially. But it's this sort of elite world that's been going on where, you know, they're gratifying their needs, but now it's about money. And so they talk to each other. They don't really care what happens to the rest of us. And so they're going to create these pet projects. They're going to get our money to pay for them. And it's to enrich them. It has no material benefit for our way of life, the energy needs we have, the longevity of our survival on the planet. It's all about self-aggrandizement and self-enrichment. And it's been made obviously immeasurably worse by the person we have in the White House, but it's been coming anyway. And so, you know, arguably that's a fault of the capitalist system as well, that's allowed this to happen and for us to believe that it's good for us.
Let's look at some of the issues that you do cover so well and so movingly and thoroughly within the book. One that is often overlooked, but I know you have an emphasis on, is the impact on Indigenous people, and especially as regards uranium mining. Why are they so targeted? Why are they so vulnerable?
All communities that lack resources, I think, tend to be vulnerable for predatory industries. And so when you're desperate for fundamentals like running water, access to electricity, I mean, never mind clean water, just any water, access to electricity, schools, resources that every society needs, it's easy to dangle promises of jobs, of fire trucks, libraries, schools, you know, the enrichment that's going to come along with some sort of nuclear project. But what you see and what I try to lay out in the book is some examples where, in fact, that's not really what happens. You know, you look at the Grand Gulf community, for example, in Mississippi, one of the poorest counties in the poorest state in the country, 80% African American, with a big nuclear power plant. But did they get, you know, all the riches from this? No, because they redistributed the tax base across the state to enrich other whiter communities. So it's just sort of easy prey factor, I think, which is what I try to look at. But it's true at every stage. I mean, that's what's really striking, is how the stories repeat themselves. We can be talking about uranium mining community. You can be talking about nuclear waste, where they tried to dump it, for example, on the Goshu Indian Reservation in Utah, in this country. You can talk about atomic testing, you know, which is obviously there are two sides of the same coin, nuclear power, nuclear weapons. And we're always talking about largely indigenous communities or brown communities or communities who are deprived low-income communities who you suspect will be more ready to accept something that's harmful to them just because it solves some near-term financial needs.
The public has been programmed to think that nuclear weapons and nuclear reactors are completely separate issues. Yet, as you just mentioned, they are connected, if not inextricably linked. How so?
Well, what's interesting about that story is that nuclear power and nuclear weapons, yes, have been looked at separately for a very long time, in large part because the nuclear power industry does not want to be associated, or didn't want to be associated, with nuclear weapons, because everybody kind of knows what nuclear weapons can do because of the pictures that we've seen now from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, albeit those were suppressed for a long, long time, but we've seen them now. And so nuclear weapons are universally accepted as being something frightening and horrific. That doesn't mean to say that we haven't bought into this crazy idea that we need them as a deterrent, but nevertheless, they know what that picture looks like. People don't really know what the nuclear power picture looks like because you don't see really images of, you know, they're not as compelling, obviously, the images of people who have had to take the brunt of the nuclear power sector. So they've successfully navigated this separation. However, that's kind of changed, actually, in the last year or so, and in a very interesting way, which is that because we've accepted, we seem to, most of us, have, not me, not you, but have accepted that we need nuclear weapons to keep us safe, and it's imperative that they keep up to date and they don't rot away and they must be modernized and refreshed and enhanced and expanded because that's what's keeping us safe, then the nuclear power industry, having found itself completely irrelevant and eclipsed by renewable energy, is now making the case that they're essential in order to continue to feed the nuclear weapons sector, and therefore they must be kept alive in order to support the nuclear weapons sector, which is manifestly not the case in the US, but is arguably the case in somewhere like Britain, where the nuclear Trident program is dependent on a steady flow of know-how, personnel, and so forth from one sector to the other, and would be potentially hard hit in finding people that can understand and work this technology. So it's an interesting shift. And similarly, there's been an interesting recent shift that I've seen, whereas nuclear power always tried to say, well, we're always on, so we're reliable, whereas renewables are intermittent, variable, and you know, you can't depend on them. And now they've realized that because actually variability is an asset, because you can bring renewables on and off the grid when their demand is there, whereas nuclear just feeds it all the time and is just therefore not economic or reliable, they're now trying to say, well, we can be intermittent too. You know, we're looking at how to make nuclear power more intermittent. So there's this sort of chameleon-like effort to fit in somewhere when in fact it's patently obsolete as a technology, and they're just trying to stay relevant in using one argument or another. I mean, actually, the climate argument, I think, has faded quite a bit from the picture that used to say, well, we're essential for the climate crisis. But now they're making it more like we're essential for domestic energy and national security. And, you know, it's touching up against the nuclear weapons section much more closely than it used to, I think.
You mentioned deterrence as the argument that's given, that we need nuclear weapons for deterrence of war. What's wrong with that argument?
Clearly, the best way not to have a nuclear war is if nobody has nuclear weapons, right? That's the deterrent. As long as you have one, I mean, I make the argument in, there's a little section of the book where I make the argument. It starts out with a skit from a British television show where the prime minister, the fake prime minister, fictional prime minister, is being sold Trident and saying, well, we don't need it. You know, why do we need it? Because no one will know if we would really use it or not. And this is the muddle around deterrence, is that, okay, if you're saying we have to have a nuclear weapon, but we would never use it, the reason it's a deterrent is it's so dangerous that everybody knows we would never use it. Well, if everybody knows that you would never use it, then you don't need it, right? And it's not a weapon. So why have it in the first place? And that also depends on your opponent believing that you would never use it. But if they suspect that you might use it, then they might use theirs before you use yours, you know, and therefore it's not a deterrent. So you can go round and round in circles on the deterrence argument, but obviously having them in the world will always risk their use, even accidentally. I mean, you may not decide to use them. We've seen, and I talk about this a little bit in the book, some close calls where computers seem to suggest that something was happening, but a human being realized that it wasn't and saved us from making a huge mistake. Now, with the onset of AI, there's a real risk, obviously, that the decision might be wrong if it's not made by a human being who can use some common sense and say, well, you know, if they were really launching an attack, there wouldn't just be two or five. There would be an en masse release of missiles. So it's probably not true, like Petrov realized, you know, one of the men who saved the world. So I think that's the trouble with deterrence, is that you have to be sure with deterrence that it's going to be 100% successful. If there's any shadow of a doubt that it could go wrong, the outcome is so catastrophic, it's not worth the risk. And since we cannot be sure that deterrence will work 100% of the time, we cannot rely on it. And therefore, we should abolish nuclear weapons as the only way to be sure that we'll never have a nuclear war.
And yet, here we are in the United States with more than 5,000 nuclear weapons stockpiled, and this push to create the pits, the firing mechanisms for new nuclear at the projected goal of 80 per year, meaning 80 more nuclear weapons, which are magnitudes larger than the ones that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. What does that say about what the U.S. is planning in the future, in your estimation?
We have to look at everything through the lens of what we're facing in the U.S. politically, which is that we've got a regime in power that is orchestrating, in my view, a quiet coup. You know, we don't have tanks rolling through our streets. Generals are not going into bunkers and taking over the government. I think there are some people who wish they would. But, you know, we've got a quiet control of everything that allows our democracy to function. So massive spending on nuclear weapons is all part and parcel, I think, of this sort of bellicose, saber rattling, showing off, look at us, we're the most powerful country in the world. We've got this, we can obliterate you. And that's one of Trump's favorite words. You know, we can obliterate you at a moment's notice without obviously realizing that includes self-obliteration. So nuclear weapons are really the definition of madness. Clearly, we're a very strange species. We seem to be intent on doing all the wrong things that will take us on an accelerated path to our own self-destruction, nuclear weapons being by far the fastest way of achieving that. And really, I think the only way to counter that is how we've done it before, which is a massive grassroots popular movement to say we don't accept this. This is not what most people want. You know, I'm sure if you polled the world, you would not get a majority of people who thought that nuclear weapons were a good idea and something they look forward to using. So we just need much more awareness of how big a risk both these technologies are, nuclear power and nuclear weapons. I mean, the argument I make in the book is really that nuclear power is in the way of both addressing the climate crisis in time and effectively and in disarmament, because if you continue to pass along the technology, know-how, materials and personnel from the to countries in order to develop civil nuclear power programs, you will always leave the back door open to a transition to nuclear weapons development, which is exactly why there's all this confusion over what Iran may or may not be doing, because they have a civil nuclear program and there's concern that that is not where it's ending. And no one can be sure what's true.
You talk about the need for a massive grassroots movement, which we did have after the accident at Three Mile Island really spooked a lot of people on the East Coast and fueled what turned into a massive turnaround in the forward progress of nuclear at that time. We've got a lot of really terrific groups with boots on the ground. They're local, they're national, they're international. We all seem to be saying the same things. We seem to be saying them at the same time. Yet, I have not perceived an international coordination of our messaging so that we end up being with one voice at one time with the maximum ability to motivate people. What do you think it would take to create an international calendar of when we come up with certain talking points, when we do certain actions, so that we can focus on it not as individual voices saying, we're talking on March 27th, tomorrow, March 28th, is the anniversary of Three Mile Island. Lots of different voices are saying that, but they're saying it in their own way. What would it take to bring us together as a unified voice, unified talking points, a unified blast of information that might have a shot of cutting through the noise that's out there and start moving people towards a unified movement to get rid of these things?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea in principle. It just hasn't worked on a practical level. I mean, there have been numerous attempts, I think, I've experienced over the years of trying, like years ago, just trying to get all the big US green groups and the smaller anti-nuclear groups to come out with one single, very simple statement saying, we are environmentalists and we do not support nuclear power as a climate solution. That seemed to be a rather straightforward thing without getting into any of the areas of differences about what should happen to the waste. You know, there are lots of different areas where we can part company on what we think should happen. It was impossible to orchestrate. Similarly, in Europe, we had a gathering in Brussels a couple of years ago. We did a big action there. There was a great enthusiasm for continuity, a sort of pan-Europe coalition. Didn't happen. Everybody ends up disappearing back into their bunkers to do their local work. So I think that's probably not practicable, but it doesn't really mean that we're not effective the way we are in terms of all these little pieces of the mosaic. You know, it's actually very important, I think, to have local movements where local people start to understand what the threat is, how to oppose it, why to oppose it. And we can support each other in those different efforts. But trying to get some sort of big mass movement, I don't think is something at this point that is going to work from a practical point of view. But in a way, it's already happening. And we do have a lot of coalitions. You know, there are meetings each week on waste, decommissioning, you know, new reactors, old reactors. I think there's a lot of cross-pollination already and unified messaging, but we don't have the financial resources to launch any kind of huge campaign that would get major attention. And we don't have the drivers of this that we used to in terms of the big green groups, which I just mentioned, because a lot of them are not engaged on this issue anymore. And so, you know, in this country, there are quite a number of the big green groups that are either not engaged or actually they're on the wrong side. And so we're not really equipped in that sense to present that unified force. But I'm encouraged by what I see regionally and the work that's being done. And I think that somehow might be more effective in the long run.
Grassroots up.
Yeah.
We'll continue with this week's featured interview with Linda Pence Gunter in just a moment. But first, nuclear weapons, reactors, radioactive waste, uranium mining, emissions, accidents. No matter where you look on the nuclear fuel chain, it's a deadly mess. But the nuclear industry spends millions of dollars on PR propaganda and languaging tricks to convince the general public that nuclear is the best thing since sliced bread. If it genuinely were, they wouldn't have to spend all that money convincing us of it. Instead, they've infiltrated the thoughts of the public and even news organizations with the idea that nukes will solve our energy problems. But that's a carefully crafted nuclear industry talking point, not the truth. And that is why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. Every week, we call out the nuclear lies and liars through interviews and news stories, providing a regular dose of verifiable nuclear news so you can understand the issues, the manipulations, and what you can do about it. Nuclear Hot Seat is the longest-running program that focuses exclusively on nuclear issues. Now concluding its 15th year as a podcast and 10th year as a broadcast through Pacifica, we have a long history of scooping mainstream media on nuclear issues, providing context and continuity to local, national, and international stories. But in order to keep doing this work, we need your help. This show runs on donations, and we're always in need of your support. Be it a one-time donation of any amount, or a recurring donation of as little as $5 a month, the same as one would spend here in the U.S. for a nice cup of coffee, all of it counts towards us being able to manage our monthly nut. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donations are tax deductible. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. If you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com, and that way, no fees are taken out. So don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate right now, and know that whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you are listening and that you care. Now back to this week's featured interview with Linda Pence Gunter on her new book, No to Nuclear. Small modular nuclear reactors have been a major talking point and a major pivot point for the nuclear industry in moving themselves forward and snagging a whole bunch of money. What do people need to know about small modular nuclear reactors?
Well, I guess there are lots of things that they need to know. I mean, one of the things we call them is PowerPoint reactors. So the first thing to know is that none of this is likely to happen anytime soon, if at all. And if you spend time and money pushing for something that may not happen anytime soon, if at all, when we could be redirecting our resources into things like renewable energy and energy efficiency that can happen right away, what's happening is that the SMR program is another obstacle to addressing the climate crisis effectively in time. What you need to know about them, and M.V. Ramana explains this brilliantly in his book, Nuclear is Not the Solution, which is really about the sort of cost effectiveness of poor economies of scale, of investing upfront in something where you need hundreds of these small modular reactors to make any kind of meaningful impact on carbon reductions. Not going to happen because it's just not cost effective when you can just build one big power plant. You don't need to try to do lots of small ones. The studies are showing that, you know, their electricity they will generate will therefore be more expensive than currently. The waste they will generate will be more voluminous than even the big reactors. The Stanford study has shown that. And a lot of them are designs, you know, they've been around for a long time. Obviously, it's not a new idea. They were always rejected in the past. They did try small reactors early on. They were rejected because they were just uneconomic. But also some of the designs are deeply flawed. You know, when you read the work of Ed Lyman, for example, at Union of Concerned Scientists, advanced isn't necessarily better or isn't always better, I think is his paper. You look at technically, the flaws in some of these reactors, they're prone to fires, they're prone to explosions, you know, they're untested. And we've got a regulatory environment which is being decapitated, which means that you've got reactors that are dangerous. I mean, they've been labeled as dangerous by the physicists who understand them. And yet they're going to be fast-tracked and there'll be an end run around safety and there won't be evacuation zones because they're so small. You know, it's really alarming how quickly they're being brought on without at least some of the safety barriers that were in place, albeit from a regulator that's been a lapdog to the industry for a long time, but at least better than nothing. But now it's looking very alarming indeed with the executive orders coming out of the White House to sort of really slash safety regulations and minimize them. We could be seeing these are experiments, in effect, that we're putting into communities potentially where it could go very badly wrong.
What role are government subsidies playing in this promotion of small modular nuclear reactors?
They're playing an essential role in any new reactors. There's also some interest still, as we can see from the sort of revival of the dead of Westinghouse, for example, to continue to build full-size reactors as well. And there's, I think, an order to build 10 of those in the U.S. by, you know, 5 minutes from now, one of the Trump executive orders, right? Completely unrealistic. There's no track record in the nuclear industry that can show that these things can come on in 5 years or less. But without subsidies, none of this is happening. The only way this is happening is if you and I pay for this, clearly, whether we pay for it in subsidies through our taxes or whether we pay for it in our rates. I mean, that's what happened, for example, in Georgia and in South Carolina, where the reactors never were delivered, which is something called construction work in progress, where you pay for the reactors even before they're complete in your electricity rates. So, you know, talking about a con, I mean, that's, you know, incredible sort of swindle on consumers. So nothing will get built without that. I think, you know, one of the great examples is Bill Gates, a multi-billionaire who has his $4 billion, which is probably going to be a lot more, $4 billion projected cost for his natrium reactor made by TerraPower, goes to the Department of Energy and insists that he get a $2 billion subsidy. So we are paying Bill Gates, half of Bill Gates's bill, to build something we don't need that has been described as cowboy Chernobyl by Ed Lyman, you know, inherently dangerous. A multi-billionaire who could sign the check himself won't do it. Why not? You have to ask that question. Why won't he take that risk with his own money then? Why do we have to foot half the bill?
There are also nuclear reactors around the country, a decommissioning fund that has been building for each of the reactors that has ranged into the multi-millions, if not the billions. How is that being sourced by the nuclear industry for their own needs or wants instead of being used for the decommissioning that the public put the money aside for?
You know, decommissioning is actually something I didn't really cover in the book. And I think when you write a book or you give a talk or anything like that, afterwards you always think, oh, you know, why didn't I mention this or why didn't I include that? And that was one of the areas I thought, okay, I didn't really get into the decommissioning piece in the book. And it's an oversight in the sense that it's such a huge part of the expense, as you just described. And it's a part of the expense that doesn't get included. You know, when we hear about the cost of nuclear power plants, it's all about the construction and operation costs. You never hear about the decommissioning, which is often more expensive than the lifetime costs of the plant. The only thing I remember hearing about, and I'm trying to remember which state it was that they had a decommissioning fund that they had invested in the stock market, which right now would be a very bad move, and was then, because we had a couple of crashes along the way. And, you know, you can't gamble with this money. This is money that's supposed to be used to cover these costs. And yeah, it's a hidden piece of the story that doesn't get told and isn't thought about. Not to mention, when you do decommission the plants, what happens to the waste and the reactor and all the other bits and pieces that you have to dispose of somehow. And a lot of that goes to so-called low-level waste dumps, which are deeply misnamed. You know, there's plutonium sometimes in these low-level waste dumps, so they're not necessarily harmless. It's just the way they categorize the waste. So yeah, that's a whole nother chapter of the story that is deliberately suppressed.
You just started your press tour to promote the book, your book, No to Nuclear. At book signings and in the media, if you've been on a podcast or a broadcast program, what has been the response of the people to whom you've been speaking?
It's been really encouraging. So far, I've only done the book tour in the UK. But in the UK, there is a really clear present danger of nuclear expansion. The UK government there is following lockstep behind the Trump administration, using exactly the same language, talking about domestic energy, jobs, and so forth. So there's a very ready audience that's heard a lot of positive things about nuclear power. And at each step of the way, I got people who came in who said they were on the fence, skeptical, not sure, who said afterwards, okay, I'm convinced now. There's no way I can accept that. The area where I got pushback a little bit, and it was from the media, not from the public, was only on the health piece of this, which was very interesting. And it's because it's so easily disputable, I think, because we don't have the precautionary principle in place, for one thing. So the burden of proof is put on the victims, or, you know, the parents of the children who have leukemia, to prove that this big nuclear facility, which is releasing ionizing radiation, which causes these very illnesses that we're seeing in elevated rates nearby, they have to prove that that's the perpetrator, when clearly it should be the other way around. That the industry should have to prove, given what we know about the health impacts of exposure to what they release, they should have to prove that they are not the cause. But that's not the way around it goes. And so, of course, fighting this through the courts, trying to get the medical studies, the epidemiological studies done, is incredibly expensive. as you know from the history of Three Mile Island as well. And so therefore, it's easy to dismiss what you can see clearly on the ground as quote-unquote anecdotal evidence or not statistically viable in some way, whereas when you look at it purely from a cause and effect point of view, it's fairly obvious that if you're seeing these kinds of elevated issues, as we did after Three Mile Island, as we do with children living close to nuclear power plants, as we certainly do around reprocessing facilities, that there's a cause, that facility, an effect, raised levels of certain illnesses in those communities. But that was the piece that they were sort of, well, you know, scientifically, it's not really proven and no one really died after Fukushima. And, you know, there's a poor understanding of the latency period as well between release and impact on health. So that was the one area I think we still need to do a better job in educating people about that.
Another aspect of that is that the studies that would prove one way or another, and you and I have our beliefs about which way it would go, the studies are not funded because the people who have got the money and who are in power don't want to have any kind of evidence out there that could prove them wrong and prove their technology wrong.
That certainly happened with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which actually did a number of years ago, I mean, more years than I care to remember now, at least 10 probably, decided to commission a cancer study. And they had 6 or 7 pilot facilities. They were all commercial nuclear power plants except the fuel production facility in Erwin, Tennessee, that they were going to use as pilot studies. And they did a first round where they called for papers and methodology and so forth. And then they canceled it. And the reason they canceled it, the reason they gave that they canceled it was that it was going to be too expensive and would be inconclusive. I mean, they're prejudging, you know, what the findings would be. And we pointed out at the time that if it was too expensive, why they just spent billions of dollars on a third building at their headquarters, which was now standing empty. They got all this money for this building, but they didn't have money to do a cancer study. It was just completely not credible, the reason they gave. And as you said, it was obvious to us that the reason they canceled it was they realized once they looked at the protocols and how it would be conducted, that it would probably show what they didn't want the world to know. And so they just quietly buried it. There have been some studies since then. I mean, there are lots of studies. And actually, at Beyond Nuclear, we have a very good radiation and health hazards expert, as you know, in Cindy Folkers, who is working with Mary Olson. And in partnership, they are looking to assemble a sort of depository of these studies so that we, when people say, well, are there studies? Have they shown that they, you can have one place where you can go and see them with maybe a synopsis of what the findings were from each one, because it gets to be very compelling. I mean, Ian Fairley, who's also a radiation researcher, you know, has done a meta-analysis of, I think, about 60 of these to sort of have a look at what are the arguments that dismiss these findings? What could the reasons be for these very obvious elevated rates of certain kinds of illnesses around these plants? And one of the conclusions he came to is also that when plants refuel, they release high bursts of radioactivity, and that maybe those moments are what contributed, because they'll say the rates of radiation release just aren't high enough to cause these kinds of outcomes, so it can't be us. But when you look at refueling and these high bursts of radiation, that could explain, in his view, I hope I'm paraphrasing this correctly, why these medical outcomes are so pronounced in those communities.
In terms of your book, and certainly as a compendium of your life, what is the meta take on it? What would be the big picture you would want to put across?
I really think we have to think deeply about how we look at our role on planet Earth. What disturbs me about the AI developments, for example, is that there seems to be this idea that we can just be kind of an autonomous species disconnected from the web of life, which is, of course, a delusion. I mean, we cannot function even without bees, let alone the entire picture. And I feel like we've lost touch with how special the planet is, how miraculous it is. You know, I see it behind you. And that, we don't see that. Most people cannot see a night sky at all because of light pollution. So there isn't that sense of wonder. Everything kind of focused on ourselves down on Earth. We disregard the other species that we live with in a very callous way. We talk about, well, he was treated like an animal, as if that's okay, you know, that an animal can be treated badly, when we should be treating animals with the same level of respect and dignity as we treat each other, because they all have a vital role to play in us surviving here. So that's the kind of greater thesis that came out of the book in looking at all this, that why are we so intent on doing something as mad as nuclear power and nuclear weapons? Is it because we've just lost track of who we are and why we're here and what we're stewarding? It was very interesting to me to see how Indigenous people don't talk about my land. They're the stewards of the land, but they don't own it. They're caretakers of it and everything that lives on it. And we don't see anything anymore. You know, we're on our phones. We don't see the real world. And we need to get back to being in nature, understanding its importance, having quiet time, and not just accept that, oh, we need data centers because we need them. No, we don't. We don't need them. We need to take a step back, live more slowly, more quietly, and appreciate and steward this planet. And that will in turn mean that we'll make the right decisions, which is not nuclear power, it's not nuclear weapons, it's not fossil fuels, it's not over-militarization, wars, you know, all the things that are feeding into our destruction could go away if we really treasure who we are and where we live and respect everything else that lives around us.
Do you think it is still possible for us to turn this around?
You know, it's funny you should ask that question, because I was thinking about that yesterday when I was driving the car, and I thought, you know, do I think we've got a chance? Personally, no. really, I think we're effed, you know, personally. But that doesn't mean, but if there's the slightest chance that by doing something we can turn this around, then we have to do it. And so we have no choice but to do it, because the prize is so huge. The prize is this precious blue marble that we live on, surviving with all of us on it. And so even though it looks really impossible and bleak, I don't see a choice of saying, oh, well, I'm just going to sit back and live a hedonistic life then and trash everything and not care. I'm not programmed that way. I don't think we should be programmed that way. And I suppose if we did all take a stand, we would turn it around. And so we can't just look to somebody else to do it. It's a bit like if somebody said, well, we really ought to do that. My rule is, well, then you have to be the first person to volunteer to do it. Because if not you, who? And so that's why we have to keep going, I think.
Goes back to the quote from Rabbi Hillel. If I am not for myself, who will be for me? If I am only for myself, what am I? And if not now, when? You've been providing the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story regularly, often every week. And I always feel great joy listening to your insights, wit, anger, and precision. What has been your goal and your guiding lights when it comes to this little miniature feature that packs such a wallop?
I'm surprised, first of all, it's been that long, really. That's amazing. But I think part of the impetus was really, you know, to boil down some current news item into a very succinct and compelling and slightly pithy and sometimes somewhat sarcastic 3 or 4 minutes, you know, to make it entertaining to listen to, not just imparting, you know, the latest dour news, because often it is rather dour, given the subject area we're dealing with and given the trend things are going in. So that was really the idea behind it. Can we tell a quick story about something really compelling that's just happened that people ought to pay attention to?
You took a break over the last year, very understandable, to finish your book and also to participate in the promotion of it. So we haven't been hearing from you very often. When do you think you're going to be back with us?
Oh, wow, you put me on the spot now. I mean, I do try to be a little bit intermittent, and I know that's not great for you because it's a little unpredictable that suddenly I say, oh, it could be on next week. But I think that's probably how it's going to go through this calendar year, mainly because we've got now quite a hectic schedule lining up for the US side of things in terms of actually traveling to places to do in-person book events at mostly bookshops, but sometimes also other venues. So it's a little unpredictable, but I'm not planning to go away. So I will inflict my 3-4 minutes or sometimes longer on you in the near future, but it might be on and off in 2026. And then, assuming there's no next book, I'll be back in force in 2027.
Can't wait to have you back with us, and I will take you intermittently if that's what's available.
You're welcome. And you know, Levy, this is how it all got started in a way, because in writing the articles for Beyond Nuclear International, which I do, and then delivering these more succinct, quick podcast items, the hot story for you, it was actually M.V. Ramana, who author of Nuclear is Not the Solution, which is an excellent book, which I also encourage people to read and takes a bit of a deeper dive into especially the SMR, small modular reactor side of things. You know, he said, why don't you make a book out of all this? And my response was, who would read it? You know? I mean, it just seemed like, okay, this isn't going to be a New York Times bestseller. And he just sort of said, look, we need more books on this subject, which I thought was actually a very generous thing to say from somebody who was just putting out his own book along quite similar lines, but from a different take, obviously. We both took it sort of from the anti-capitalist point of view, but there are other pieces that I focus on that he doesn't and vice versa. So that really, you know, he listens to Nuclear Hot Seat and he listened to the hot story and he thought this could make a good book. So he's to blame for the success or failure of this, but also, you know, tells you that you've got very active listeners who are thinking, you know, this could work in other ways. So really your show was sort of the springboard for getting this book off the ground. So you should take some credit for that as well. And you are, as you saw, credited in the book, quite rightly so, for being one of the people that got this off the ground and encouraged me to do it, because I don't think I would have otherwise.
Anytime you need encouragement to do anything, Linda, just give me a call, shoot me a text. I am here for you because your work is so superb, so necessary, and so appreciated, even if you don't hear that back all the time.
Well, thank you. Now you're now my official therapist then. Anytime I'm feeling a bit discouraged, I'll just go talk to you. Because you've got this positive energy, which we absolutely need, you know, and I think we often, you know, we don't celebrate our successes either nearly enough. And one of the criticisms I hear sometimes is that we're too down about, you know, it's all too negative. It's all too, oh gosh, you know, and we ought to be much more excited even about the mini breakthroughs that we do have. And of course, in our world, that's often nothing happened, you know, which is a very difficult thing to celebrate, but is success. Some horrible nuclear project didn't happen or is delayed or isn't happening yet. That's often down to us pushing back and mounting opposition. And we should praise ourselves for that. And we don't do it nearly enough.
Well, I praise you and I accept the praise for myself and for all the rest of the brave, undaunted, still operating activists out there with the hope that there's going to be a new generation coming in to be the bulwark into the future.
Yeah, we really need them. And they are the unsung heroes. You know, they're the people I feel the most grateful to because they're doing the hard work on the ground, often thankless, often against really quite nasty opposition. We've all been on the receiving end of a lot of ad hominem attacks. And I always feel like, well, if that's all they've got, then we're winning, clearly. But nevertheless, we face a lot of that negative energy from the other side. So I really admire the people that have stuck with it all these many, many years. And yes, we're aging out and we need new blood. And hopefully we'll see that soon.
Your book is incredibly important, and it comes at a time at a crossroads when we really need it. It's called No to Nuclear. We should all memorize that. And I want to thank you for your generosity in being an often weekly correspondent with Nuclear Hot Seat. You've taken a break with the book and with the promotion of the book. Hopefully, we'll have you back soon. And for now, thank you so much for all that you do and for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Well, thank you. And really, I could just repeat what you just said to me back to you, frankly, because you give us such an incredible variety of information every week on so many different aspects of this important subject in an equally accessible way that anyone can understand. So I think between us and all the others out there who I deeply appreciate doing the hard work on the ground, you know, we're a force to be reckoned with and we've just got to keep going.
I'm not planning on stopping anytime soon and I look forward to being in the harness with you.
Thank you. Me too.
Linda Pence Gunter. She is a former journalist with Reuters, USA Network, and The Times in the UK, among other credits. She is founder and executive director of Beyond Nuclear, the head of Beyond Nuclear International, and her new book, No to Nuclear, Why Nuclear Power Destroys Lives, Derails Climate Progress, and Provokes War, has just been published by Pluto Books. To celebrate the launch, Pluto Books is providing a 40% off discount until April 8 on this and all their energy transition books. We will have a link up so you can take advantage of it on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 770. Linda can be reached at linda@beyondnuclear.org. M.V. Ramana's book, which she mentioned very highly, Nuclear is Not the Solution, which focuses on the problems of small modular nuclear reactors, was the subject of a past Nuclear Hot Seat interview, and we will link to it on the website. And some clarification on a few points that we zipped past on the interview. In talking about nuclear accidents narrowly averted, Linda quickly referenced Petrov. That was Stanislav Petrov, a lieutenant colonel in the Soviet Union's Air Defense Forces. His job was to monitor his country's satellite system, which was looking for any possible nuclear weapons launches by the United States. In 1983, he played a key role in the Soviet nuclear false alarm incident by refusing to push the nuclear button in response to what turned out to be false data indicating a U.S. nuclear launch at Russia. In a very real way, he helped avert nuclear Armageddon. Stanislav Petrov was also the subject of the award-winning film The Man Who Saved the World. We'll have a link up to our interview with the film's director and producer, and the database compilation of studies on the impact of nuclear radiation is being developed by Cindy Folkers of Beyond Nuclear, and to give her partner in this her full due, Mary Olson, who founded and heads Generational Radiation Impact Project, or GRIP. The link will be up on our website. A reminder that we now have transcripts available for the episodes now and moving forward. It's going to take a while to catch up with the ones from the past, but trust me, we are working on it so that you have not only the ability to hear the episode, but to read through and find the portions that are most applicable and important to you. And if you're looking for another book to read, Yes, I Glow in the Dark, 1 mile from Three Mile Island to Fukushima and Nuclear Hot Seat. That would be my book about having been 1 mile from the nuclear reactors at Three Mile Island when the meltdown happened 47 years ago. Of course, there's a link to that also on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, on the landing page and everywhere else you can possibly look. Check it out. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, March 31st, 2026. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, we make it so easy. Sign up for it on your favorite podcast channel, or better for us, go to nuclearhotseat.com. In the yellow opt-in box, you really can't miss it, put in your first name and email address, and every week you will get one email with a link to that week's show as soon as it posts and a short description of its content. That way, you need never miss a single episode of this show. And with all the breaking nuclear news in the world, you really don't want to be missing one. Now, community involvement requested. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, that's the way we keep alive and keep going. So thank you. Any amount will help us out, and we really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2026, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, we can always come up with the date that a nuclear emergency begins, but we can never come up with a date that it's over, because once it starts, it's never over. Never. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.